Before we begin, a quick content note. This episode contains detailed descriptions of executions, which some listeners may find disturbing. Hello, and welcome to Discussions with DPIC. I'm Anne Holsinger, the Information and Resource Specialist at the Death Penalty Information Center.
And I'm Robin Conrad, DPIC's Director of Research and Special Projects.
Last month, we recorded our podcast shortly before Arkansas had scheduled the execution of 8 men over 11 days in the last 2 weeks in April. The executions of Bruce Ward and Don Davis were scheduled on Monday, April 17th. The executions of Stacy Johnson and Liddell Lee were scheduled on Thursday, April 20th. The executions of Jack Jones and Marcel Williams were scheduled on April 24th. And the executions of Jason McGeehee and Kenneth Williams were scheduled on Thursday, April 27th. Arkansas ended up carrying out 4 of those 8 executions. The 2 executions scheduled for Monday, April 17th, were both stayed. Arkansas then carried out 1 of the 2 executions scheduled for Thursday, April 20th. The following week, Arkansas carried out a double execution on Monday, April 24th, and carried out 1 of the 2 executions on Thursday, April 27th. Today we are joined by Scott Braden and Julie Vandiver, 2 attorneys with the Capital Habeas Unit in the Office of the Federal Public Defender for the Eastern District of Arkansas. Julie has been representing Arkansas death row prisoners with the office for 8 years. Scott has been with the office for 11 years and has been representing death row prisoners for 30 years. Scott has witnessed 13 executions, including 2 of the recent Arkansas executions. The Federal Public Defender's Office represented 4 of the 8 Arkansas prisoners who were scheduled for executions. 3 of their 4 clients obtained a stay of execution, and 1 client, Marcel Williams, was executed on April 24th. Welcome, Julie and Scott.
Hi, you.
So, we were wondering if we could start off by walking through what happens in the days and hours leading up to an execution. Specifically, who is visiting the prisoners, where are they being housed, and do they have an opportunity to visit with their family?
They are allowed to visit their family up until 24 hours before the execution. Arkansas's death row is housed at Varner, which is a maximum security facility, but the executions are carried out at Cummins. It's just down the road from Varner, and so they move the guys about 2 days before the execution to Cummins. And there they house them in these little, extremely small cage-type cells, just big enough to have a bed and a toilet in it. And it's a very tight space. They allow the lawyers to visit. I know I visited Marcel Williams on the Saturday before his Monday execution, and they brought him out, and we visited with him in a conference room, which was spacious. But on the day of the execution, they only would let the lawyers visit at the holding facility, which was really tight, and it's very inaccessible as far as telephone communication or anything like that.
And it's actually attached to the execution chamber. It's one building, and on one side is the execution chamber, and then on the other side is the holding cells.
How far in advance are the prisoners moved to this holding cell that's attached to the execution chamber?
It depends, and I think that they would have done it differently had they not had so many executions stacked up together. There's only 2 cells there. As far as I know, as far as I could see, there's only 2 cells there. I don't know if there's another part of that building. But so they had these executions scheduled for a Monday and a Thursday and a Monday and a Thursday. And so for Marcel, and I know for Don Davis, who was also scheduled for a Monday, they moved them on the Friday before.
And are they being monitored for this entire period while they're in the holding cell?
They have a person that's assigned to sit there outside their cell. And so it's 2 cells separated by a shower area, and they have an officer that sits there and writes down everything they do for the time that they're in this death house. They can't flush their own toilets. There's a switch on the a button on outside of the cell. So if they go to the bathroom, they have to tell the officer that they need their toilet flushed. I think they also can't get water without, I'm not positive about that, but I think that they have to have all that is operated outside the cell by a button that can be pushed by this same officer that's writing down everything that they do.
It's almost slightly comical to a certain degree how minute they record everything, going to the toilet, getting a drink of water. And Julie is correct. You cannot even turn on the sink without the person outside the cell pushing the button to turn on the sink.
What is the purpose of those records? Are they made publicly available after an execution?
You know, I don't know. I know the New York Times did a story, which I stumbled on in the process of this, I think, for the Arkansas's last double execution, which was about 17 years ago. And in that story, they had that journal, and they reported it. And where they got it or how they got it, I don't really know. I don't know what the purpose for it is.
Let's talk about the litigation that was happening, because there was a lot going on in each of these cases. Some of the litigation was specific to each separate prisoner, and some of it was big picture litigation. I know that you all had a challenge to the lethal injection process and a challenge to the clemency process. And if we could start by telling our listeners about the lethal injection challenges that were raised. And as we understood it, there were really two main issues, one that involved concerns with the drug protocol itself, and another regarding access to counsel during these executions or leading up to them. And so would you mind, one of you, give our listeners kind of an update of what happened? Because when we recorded our last podcast, you all were in the middle of having a hearing on those issues.
The lethal injection, we had sort of a couple of, Scott will talk about the scheduling claim, but we had a straight up claim based on the three drug protocol, which used midazolam as the first drug, vecuronium bromide, and then potassium chloride, which is the same protocol that has been used in other states and has been abandoned by other states. And our claim was that the midazolam was not going to work as the prison expected to sufficiently anesthetize the prisoner, and so that they would feel pain from the injection of the vecuronium bromide, which is a paralytic and can cause the sensation of suffocation, and the potassium chloride, which is a strong acid and burns when it's injected. One of the issues, because of the Supreme Court case law, is that we have to plead an alternative.
I'm going to stop you for a moment, Julie, to briefly explain to our listeners what it means to, quote, plead an alternative. In 2015, the Supreme Court decided a case called Glossop versus Gross. It originated from a lawsuit brought by Oklahoma death row prisoners who argued that the use of a three-drug protocol with midazolam, the same one used here in Arkansas, violated the Eighth Amendment. There, the prisoners took the position that showing that this protocol would likely result in severe pain and suffering was sufficient to show a constitutional violation and obtain relief. Five of the justices disagreed and said that in order for a condemned prisoner to successfully challenge a state's protocol as unconstitutional, he must also provide an alternative way for the state to carry out the execution. In other words, the prisoner has to design his own method of execution. Julie, in your case, what alternatives to the three-drug midazolam protocol did you plead?
We pled pentobarbital as an alternative, and then also sevoflurane gas, because the was able to find a company that said that they would sell sevoflurane gas to the ADC for the purpose of executions. So that's one of the big stumbling blocks in this lethal injection litigation is how are we supposed to prove what the Department of Corrections can get access to. And So we had a four-day evidentiary hearing in front of the district court, the federal district court here, in front of Christine Baker, who's an Obama appointee. We had some concerns about whether or not we were going to be able to get all the evidence in time. Initially, the hearing had been scheduled for 3 days. We asked for it to go Monday through Friday, and this was the week before the execution, so the executions were to start on Monday. We ended up by agreement going to Thursday, and the judge held court until 8:15 at night. She started at 8:30 in the morning, and then we went till 8:15 at night, except for the first day. We didn't go that long. And then on the last day, we went till 9:45. And I think we ended up having 17 witnesses. It was an enormous amount of work for a four-day hearing. Ultimately, the district court ruled in our favor and granted us a preliminary injunction on that midazolam claim. The Saturday before the executions, that was a 101-page opinion. And the judge, I thought, there was a lot of competing expert testimony. She made a lot of credibility determinations, finding our experts were more credible for a variety of reasons, and finding that we at least proved enough at that stage regarding alternatives. One thing that I think was significant that we learned in this hearing was how very little the ADC had actually tried to get other drugs.
ADC is the Arkansas Department of Corrections.
Right. I was really surprised at the testimony that they, first of all, that they had not they didn't have to do much to get the drugs they did have, and that they hadn't tried really to get any drugs other than the ones that they already had. So, and, you know, Scott will talk about this scheduling issue, but they scheduled 8 executions to happen in 11 days, and the ostensible reason why they needed to do this insane schedule is that the midazolam was going to expire on April 30th. The guy that was in charge, he testified that he hadn't taken any steps to get more drugs, any of the 3 drugs that are in the protocol, because according to him, he had what he needed. They'd been saying that they weren't going to be able to get more, but they haven't even tried to get more. And they had said the same thing about vecuronium bromide, which had expired in, I can't remember if it's June of 2015 or 2016, but they, in another court, we had asked for an extension that would sort of butt up against that expiration date, and they just raised all kinds of objections that they would never be able to get that drug again, and they got it 2 weeks after their old supply expired, and the testimony at the hearing was they made one phone call and got it.
Now, let me interrupt you for just a second and ask you about the second drug, which is the vecuronium bromide, because there was an unrelated lawsuit, and I say unrelated to the prisoners, that was filed by McKesson, the company that supplied the vecuronium bromide. And if you could, I know you weren't involved in that litigation, but if you could give a brief description of what happened there related to the drugs, the second drug, the vecuronium bromide.
I'll tell you what I know, and I believe that the factual genesis of that lawsuit came out of the transcripts from our hearing, because this the deputy director that's supposed to be acquiring these drugs testified at our hearing that he got them from somebody who wasn't supposed to be selling them to him, and that if that person had been doing what they were supposed to do, they wouldn't have been able to get them.
And why wasn't the person supposed to be selling drugs to the Department of Corrections?
Because McKesson and lots of these pharmaceutical companies do not want to be selling their drugs for the purpose of executions. And so my understanding is that there's the manufacturers have these agreements that say that you can't sell them to a Department of Corrections for the purpose of lethal injection. You can sell them to a Department of Corrections, but not for use in execution. So the allegation was that in the McKesson lawsuit, which, again, we had nothing to do with. I mean, it was news to us when it happened. But the allegation in that complaint was that this guy, his name's Rory Griffin, called a contact that he had at McKesson that he had from dealing with the hospital operations or the health side operations of the prison and tried to purchase the vecuronium bromide or did purchase the vecuronium bromide without disclosing what the purpose of it was, that he was intending to use it for executions, and that once they realized that they had sold it for the purpose of executions, I'm not sure how they realized that, they asked for it back and, in fact, refunded the Department of Corrections the money. They, on Friday, they got a temporary restraining order issued the Friday before the executions were to begin, preventing them from using the vecuronium bromide, which would effectively prevent the Department of Corrections from doing any of the executions. That ultimately got vacated by the Arkansas Supreme Court. McKesson, I think, ended after Judge Baker issued her preliminary injunction.
A preliminary injunction was issued by the federal district court judge on the Saturday morning, less than 48 hours after you had concluded your evidentiary hearing. And there were two executions scheduled for the following Monday. And so what ultimately happened with her order?
It was in front of the Eighth Circuit in an emergency posture on that Monday because, as you said, Bruce Ward got a stay of execution on Friday, but Don Davis still had an execution date. And around, I want to say, 2 or 3 o'clock, because it was after Scott had left for the prison, the Arkansas Supreme Court stayed both Bruce and Don's executions in an unrelated case. And so we thought that the Eighth Circuit might just wait and that it wouldn't have to issue an opinion on the motion to vacate the preliminary injunction that day, but it went ahead and issued an opinion. I think it was around 6 o'clock that day. There was a dissent by Jane Kelly.
And so ultimately, this challenge was, the preliminary injunction was vacated by the Eighth Circuit over one dissent, and then you appealed that to the Supreme Court, right? And can you tell the listeners what happened with regard to the Supreme Court and its ruling on the use of midazolam in a three-drug protocol during these eight, you know, at that point in time, there were still some executions pending that Arkansas was planning to carry out?
Yeah. So we filed a stay of execution and a petition for cert in the United States Supreme Court, which was denied. And Justice Ginsburg and Sotomayor would have granted the stay of execution and the petition for cert, and then Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan would have granted the stay of execution. So we didn't have enough votes for either the stay motion or the cert petition.
Just a little background for our listeners who aren't familiar with how the Supreme Court works. A majority of Supreme Court justices, that is 5 of the 9 justices, must vote in favor of a stay of execution in order for one to be issued. However, if the court wants to review a case, it needs only 4 justices to vote in favor of review. This presents a dilemma in capital cases where there is an imminent execution scheduled because there may be 4 justices who agree that the case warrants review, but not 5 justices who are willing to issue a stay. Now, let's go back to the other aspect of the case that Julie has mentioned about the scheduling of these 8 executions in less than a 2-week period. Scott, what was the legal challenge that was raised regarding the truncated scheduling of all of these executions?
What we were saying is that that Congress had guaranteed the right to counsel under a federal statute for persons that had been sentenced to death that were appealing to federal courts from a state conviction, and that having 8 executions set in a 10-day period effectively denied the clients this right to counsel. Now, we didn't represent everybody, but under the fact that we are a habeas unit, we had involvement in a lot of cases. We represented 4 of the 8. One lawyer who is a panel lawyer, or a lawyer that's just appointed by the court, a lawyer that's just in private practice, represented 3 of the guys, and then one guy was represented by another panel lawyer or lawyer in private practice. And but part of our role as the habeas unit is to provide assistance, so we effectively were involved in all the cases. And it was just impossible to do that and to deal with all of these clients. But it really prevented us from being able to represent each individual guy, because every minute we were spending on preparing and getting ready for this lethal injection challenge and these bigger challenges to the whole process, that is just time that was taken away from working with the individual clients and their specific individual cases.
Well, and Scott, just the being able to communicate with your client when you have so many, you know, there's not enough time in the day to be able to call each person or go visit them. I can only imagine how challenging that would have been as well.
The prison is about an hour away, and it's usually about half a day trip to just go down and see 1 or 2 people, and we just didn't have the time to be doing that, and
yeah,
it
just
feels horrible.
We just couldn't devote the time to, you know, if we had just one guy that had a date, we might be able to somebody in our office might be able to go down and talk to him, explain to him what's going on. But, you know, when we were just so overwhelmed and everybody was involved in this, and I wouldn't say that we were at the office 24 hours a day, but I think it was close. I think there were several, more than one night where we were there till 3 and 4 in the morning. It was very difficult on the lawyers, and it was, and just our office as a whole. And, you know, and it was, as you can imagine, it had a great impact on all the lawyers' families and their children and stuff like that. But the thing where it really hurt a lot, as you've mentioned, as Julie's mentioned, is just with the clients. They just weren't necessarily involved as they should have been, because we didn't have time to involve them. And then the other thing that I really worried a lot about and still worry a lot about is the choices we had to make. I mean, every waking moment we were having to make these incredible life and death choices between, should we work on this part of somebody's individual case, or do we need to spend some time getting ready and developing this challenge to lethal injection, which would involve everybody? It was a really difficult ethical dilemma that lawyers shouldn't have to be placed in.
So what evidence did you present at the hearing to support the claim that the prisoners were being denied their right to counsel because of Arkansas's execution schedule?
Part of our hearing, we had Lawrence Vogt, who is a lecturer on ethics and who has done a lot around the country on lawyers and legal ethics, testify at this hearing about the ethical dilemma this places us in and how this effectively is a denial of counsel. He also testified that all of us had an ethical obligation to just withdraw because we couldn't meet our ethical obligations. But the reality of that is different. You know, we couldn't, one, I doubt that any court would let us out, and two, I doubt that we just couldn't leave, you know, move to withdraw on our guys that we've represented for so long.
Well, ultimately, you lost on that claim because the district court determined that even though, as you said earlier, Scott, there is a federal statute that provides state death sentence prisoners with a right to counsel, there was no right to effective assistance of counsel. I know that may seem confusing to our listeners, because what's the point of having counsel if your counsel does not need to be effective? But that was the court's ruling in this case. So even though you ultimately didn't succeed on that legal claim for relief, I know our listeners appreciate understanding what it was like for you both to work on so many cases at the same time. But now let's turn to an issue that was a win for you and your clients. Let's talk about the claim that involved the state's denial of access to counsel during the execution itself. Can you provide us with some background on that issue?
Well, the Department of Corrections had initially said that, I think they started out saying that only one lawyer would be able to witness the execution, and which is different from what they'd done in the past 10 or 11 years ago when they'd had executions before, but that only one lawyer would be able to be a witness of the execution. Our concern was that if something had gone wrong, like it had happened, say, in Arizona in Mr. Wood's execution, and there was, as you know, there was a hearing on that in the course of the execution, because the lawyers were able to, there was multiple lawyers there, one was able to step out and had access to a telephone and could communicate with the judge, and there was a hearing on the telephone as the execution took place. We would not be able to have that under the protocol that they proposed.
They said that we would have to drive, they would drive us to a phone.
So in other words, one lawyer would be able to witness if anything went wrong. That lawyer would have to leave and would no longer be able to witness.
Right.
So the district court judge issued an order regarding the access to counsel during execution claim. Tell us what happened.
She ordered us to negotiate it. And so the prison did agree to let there be two lawyer witnesses. The other thing that was really at issue was phone access. And as Julie mentioned, they said they would drive us to a telephone, but you know, that just was not workable. You know, that just would not workable in these situations where just seconds count. And so they finally agreed to let us have a cell phone, but it had to be a cell phone that did not have a camera on it, so that you could not take pictures. And so we had a computer person who we sent on a mission to find one. I think she found the last one made in America that actually doesn't have a camera on it. So,
officer had to hold it, right?
Right. So when we entered into the prison each time, we had to surrender it at the gate, and there was a prison person who was designated to hold the phone. That was like his job, was to hold our phone. And so we didn't have access to it unless we went to that person and asked them if we could have the phone, which came up a couple times. We used it, I think, once while we were waiting on Don Davis. There was a long period there. Don Davis and Bruce Ward had gotten a stay out of the Arkansas Supreme Court on state-related issues, but the state filed a motion to lift that stay in the U.S. Supreme Court. But we just didn't know what was going on, so we were able to call and find out.
Well, let me just stop you there, and let's talk briefly about each individual case. What happened? So we know that the first two executions that were scheduled on Monday, April 17th, who you mentioned, Bruce Ward and Don Davis, were ultimately stayed by the Arkansas Supreme Court. And if you could tell us very briefly why those executions were stayed and what's happening now. Did they ultimately get relief? Are they off death row? Or do they just have more proceedings that are going to happen in their case?
Mr. Ward got stays basically for two reasons. One, we had pending a challenge to his competency to be executed. He's pretty severely mentally ill, and we had challenged that in the county court in Arkansas, and that got denied. And we had appealed that to the Arkansas Supreme Court, and the Arkansas Supreme Court granted a stay of execution on that to allow briefing of that county court's denial. But at the same time, we had also filed a challenge in Mr. Ward's case and in Mr. Davis' case because it had a similar issue about the denial of expert assistance during their trials. It's a complex issue, but to summarize it real quickly, they had requested to have independent mental health examinations at their trial, but instead Arkansas had sent them to the state hospital and said, well, that's sufficient. The state hospital is the independent mental health expert that the Constitution requires. But at the same time, the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing basically this issue. So we had asked the Arkansas Supreme Court to stay both those cases because they had this issue that was pending in the U.S. Supreme Court. And so the Arkansas Supreme Court stayed that as well. So those two cases are now pending in the Arkansas Supreme Court awaiting briefing on those issues. On Thursday, it was Stacey Johnson and Liddell Lee. And so Stacey Johnson had, we did not represent Stacey Johnson, but the lawyer that represented him had challenged some DNA evidence that had not been presented to the courts before, and the Arkansas Supreme Court granted a stay in Stacey Johnson to allow time to deal with the DNA evidence in that case, but they did not grant anything on Liddell Lee, who had a similar issue, so they denied that, and he ultimately was executed.
So the Arkansas Supreme Court had before it stay motions from two prisoners, both with claims of innocence and both seeking additional DNA testing to prove their innocence. One received a stay and the other didn't. Liddell Lee, whose execution was not stayed, was executed on Thursday, April 20th. His execution was initially scheduled for earlier in the evening, but his execution wasn't carried out until nearly midnight. Can you explain the procedural posture of that case and what happened with his case with regard to the United States Supreme Court and the Arkansas Supreme Court's involvement?
He had a variety of vehicles for relief. He ended up getting a stay while one of those things was being considered in the Eighth Circuit granted a couple stays, and then the United States Supreme Court granted just a temporary stay for them to consider those issues, which didn't end up getting lifted. I think it got lifted at like 11:22 or something, and the warrant in Arkansas, the warrant expires at midnight. And so there was a motion filed both in the Arkansas Supreme Court and then in front of Judge Baker that wasn't going to be enough time for Liddell Lee to be executed. The Arkansas Supreme Court denied the motion without prejudice. And then we tried to have a telephone hearing with Judge Baker, but I think by the time we were actually on the phone with her, there was technological problems, and I think she talked to the Attorney General. He was dead. I think he was pronounced dead at 11:56.
Okay, so the first week Arkansas was scheduled to carry out four executions and it carried out one. Let's fast forward to the second week where they were again scheduled to carry out two double executions on a Monday and a Thursday. And Monday they did successfully carry out two executions. Scott, I know that you witnessed those two executions, so if you can give our listeners a brief description of what happened and what issues there were related to those executions.
So the first execution that day was Jack Jones, and there had been several issues around Mr. Jones and Mr. William both, who about the access to their veins, because both of them were severe diabetics. And matter of fact, Mr. Jones is so severe that he has had to have his foot amputated some years ago. So about 1 o'clock, I think we arrived at the prison. And as I mentioned earlier, once you get into the prison, you're pretty much cut off. And so Julie and John Williams and other lawyers back in the office were kind of handling the last-minute stuff. But at the prison, they made us wait about 2 hours before we could see Marcel, which became so annoying that we called the court at that point to ask the court to intervene on this, because we had fought this whole access to the clients out, and we felt like that 2 hours was significant enough that we were being deprived access to the counsel.
Scott, do you know what the reason for the delay was? I mean, because I think you told the listeners earlier they weren't having family visits that last day.
That they didn't explain to us, and we asked multiple times, and we multiple times we wanted to know what. At one point, they told us he was Jack and Marcel were having their last meal, but certainly that didn't take 2 hours. But just as we called the court and got the clerk on the phone to start asking for some intervention, then they relented and let us go see the client with Marcel, who is who we were seeing. His spiritual advisor was there, and Jack Jones had a spiritual advisor as well, who had been with them the whole time, so I don't really know what the delay was. So about 7 o'clock, everything had been lost in the court, and so we gathered outside. You know, it's kind of this odd thing. You just gather outside in this kind of parking lot outside this little room, and the different witnesses, the media witnesses, and they have this thing in Arkansas where they have citizen witnesses, you know, where they just supposedly have volunteers that are supposed to come and be witnesses, but they all look like people from the Attorney General's office to me. But they take them into the execution room, and then the lawyers are taken in last, and we sit on the back row. And so the execution started fairly promptly with Jack Jones. As soon as we got in, they opened the curtains, and the director asked him if he had any last words. He had quite a few last words. And then they started the process. There's a person there who he's the designee. Under the protocol, they designate some person to watch the IV access and so forth, who did that with Jack Jones. And
Scott, just so our listeners are aware, because it's different in different states, the execution process that occurs in Arkansas, the witnesses do not see the entire process, correct? You're not seeing the prisoner being brought in, strapped to the gurney, and you're not seeing the IV inserted. The witnesses only see from the middle of the execution process in Arkansas. Is that correct?
That's correct. So when we were brought into the room, the room is fairly dark. I would say it's like if you go into a dimly lit movie theater, you know, there's just enough light just so that you can kind of see, you know, to find your spot. And, you know, there's a big 4-pane window in front of you that have curtains drawn across it. You can kind of tell that there's people on the other side. Obviously, you can kind of, you know, hear voices and stuff, but you don't see anything that's going on in there, so you don't really know what's happening. And then after you've been in the room a little bit, then the curtain will open up, and, you know, it's it just floods the room with light, and then there's the prisoner strapped down on this table with his head to our left and his feet to our right, and just almost immediately the director begins in on this process of asking about last words. But as far as setting the IV or bringing the prisoner into the room or any of that kind of stuff, we don't see any of that. We've asked about that. We've wanted that. We've thought about that, but we've never been successful on that. So then they start this process. The person that's the designee on Jack Jones spent quite a little time kind of prodding on Jack's mouth with what looked like a tongue depressor, and as the chemicals, I assume, the midazolam was being injected into him.
Is that consistent with their written protocol, the tongue depressor?
No.
You know, the protocol, you know, they're supposed to inject the midazolam, and then they're supposed to wait 5 minutes and do a consciousness check. And then, it looked to me like they were trying to do this through the whole time. I mean, this guy was kind of, kind of putting this tongue depressor in Jack's mouth, kind of pulling on his chin. But I would say about 4 minutes, 3 or 4 minutes after, and, you know, I don't know when the drugs start. There's no indication to us. So I just assume when the director, you know, steps away after he's made his last statement, they must start injecting the drugs, but they don't announce that or anything. And so then this designee, this person in the room, did something that was more in line with a consciousness check. You could see him open Jack's eyelids and poke on his eyeball and rub his eyelashes and do different things like that. During this time, you could see that Jack was very heavily breathing. You know, his chest was really going up and down in these really obvious labored breathing kind of things. His lips were moving a little bit. And then, again, we don't know the order. I mean, we know the order of drugs, but we don't know when they're actually injecting them. We have no idea. Then at some point, he did become still. Then this guy did something with a stethoscope, and then another man entered the room, who I think must be the coroner, and he came around and listened to his chest and so forth, and then pronounced his death, and then he left the room. And the minute then the director came to the window, and she read some sort of formalized proclamation, I guess, you know, that Mr. Jones was executed to carry out the order of the, I think it was Pulaski County Court, and the curtains close, and that's it. You know, then we're taken away.
Scott, after Jack Jones was pronounced deceased, I understand that there was an emergency hearing. So, Julie, can you talk briefly about what that hearing was about and what happened?
We heard from Jeff Rosenzweig, who represented Jack Jones, because he wasn't going to be staying for Marcel's execution. He was able to call us from that warden's office and tell us that, in his words, that Jack was gulping or gasping like a fish out of water during his execution. And so we thought that that was significant and troubling, and so we filed an emergency motion, and the court held a telephone hearing. It got the AG on. She stayed the execution for, I think it was 20 minutes or until further order of the court. So we had a evidentiary hearing. We actually were able to get Jeff as a witness, Scott as a witness on that chew burner phone, and Jack's spiritual advisor, who was on her way back from the prison. We had all of them on the phone. We had a bunch of cell phones pushed up against a speakerphone, and we had Dr. Zivit, our anesthesiologist. Ultimately, we did not prevail, and the reason why is because, as Scott said, we couldn't say when they were getting the drug, when he was getting the drug. So we weren't able to prove that the time that he was gasping was after he had been given the vecuronium bromide, which would be consistent with what our theory of how these drugs are going to work was.
Okay, so then Marcel Williams, his execution was carried out that evening, correct?
Yes. And, you know, as I described in Jack Jones, when we entered the room for Marcel Williams, well, we entered the room twice. We went in first, and then they came out, and somebody came out, I forget who, and said, there's been a stay for 20 minutes. So after a while, the people left the room. All the witnesses left the room. They even took Marcel off the table and took him back to the holding cell, but just briefly. So when we entered the room the second time on Marcel, we waited about, I think it was about 45 minutes we waited for. There was nothing that we could see. I mean, obviously there was something going on in the execution room. The curtains were drawn. There was people walking around. You could kind of tell. You could hear voices. My assumption is that they were having great difficulty getting venous access. In other words, okay, they couldn't get the IVs put in.
But you couldn't see this. And when you say you could hear, was there audio, like a microphone or?
No, there was no, there is a microphone, but they keep it turned off. But you could just hear the mumblings of, you know, you could just hear, you couldn't hear words. You could just hear sound from the other room. And it wasn't, it's just, you know, like you could just hear somebody next door or something. You could just hear the sound of voices, but you couldn't hear what anybody was saying. So you knew, we knew something was going on in there.
And they had asked Marcel multiple times, including that morning while I was visiting him at the prison, if he would agree to have a central line placed. And, you know, on our advice, he said no.
And so after about 45 minutes, is that when the curtain opened and you witnessed his execution?
It had gone long enough that Jamie Gianni, who was the other witness with me on Marcel, we had decided that we were going to give them five more minutes, and then we were going to step out and call the courts. But literally 1 minute later, the curtain opened, and so they carried out the process with Marcel. It's very clear that he had much more difficulty breathing, and, you know, his head moves more. It's really hard to tell when somebody's in distress in this situation because they're so strapped down, that their head's strapped down, their head's in a block, so some sort of block kind of thing, so they can't move back and forth as much.
Well, and Scott, do you have any medical training?
No, I didn't. I don't.
So my guess is that even if the person may be in distress, to a lay witness, they might not be able to tell that.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. And, you know, that's part of the whole issue is the second drug is a paralytic, and they could be in great distress, and you wouldn't know it. They can't move, you know.
One of the media witnesses who had a bit of a different vantage than Scott saw Marcel's back arching up off of the table.
So there was some concerns with these executions. I want to briefly take us to the very last day of the of the execution schedule. That was Thursday, April 27th, where Arkansas had set the execution of Jason McGahey and Kenneth Williams. Jason McGahey's execution ended up getting stayed. And if you could give the listeners a quick overview of what happened and why he got a stay.
He was actually the first person to get a stay, and the reason that he got a stay is because he got a recommendation from the clemency board, a 6-1 recommendation that clemency be granted for him. We had a separate clemency lawsuit that we haven't talked about, but the short version of that is that the way that they had scheduled the clemency hearings did not give enough time for the governor to receive and act on that recommendation before he would have been executed. And so the federal district court granted him a stay of execution for long enough for that statutorily required notice period, which would have expired on May 5th. And the state decided not to appeal that stay decision.
And what's happening in his case now? Has the governor acted on the clemency recommendation for Mr. McGehee?
He has not, and it is before him right now. There's no deadline for him to make that decision.
And then neither of you witnessed the execution of Kenneth Williams.
Correct.
But can you give the listeners a very brief description of what happened with his execution and what's next in the litigation related to lethal injection because of what happened in his execution?
Well, two lawyers from the Philadelphia Capital Habeas Unit were witnesses to Kenneth Williams. We, of course, were in our office to try to provide whatever support we can, could, in about 3 or 4 minutes after it started. I'm not sure exactly what time that was, but we got a call from our cell phone, which we had loaned to them so they could have telephone access. And they, one of the lawyers there had stepped out because he was really concerned about Mr. Williams. He had, was gasping for breath. He was, I think, moving his head. And I don't remember all of the stuff that he described. But at that point, you know, it was very difficult for us to know what to advise because we don't know when these drugs are injected. So we don't know what is causing what at that time. So we advised him to go back into the room and watch for other symptoms. Mr. Williams obviously died there, but there was a lot of concern from not just the witnesses, the legal witnesses, but from the press about him moving his head and gasping for air and so forth. Their concerns, I think, were even more so than what happened with Jack Jones and Marcel Williams. But there was a lot of concern about that execution. And, you know, what's going to happen next? I don't know. Julie might be a little bit better to talk about that. She's a lot more in tune with the lethal injection challenge. But it's still an ongoing process. It's just we just didn't win our preliminary injunction. After the execution, we decided that we needed to have them preserve a certain amount of evidence, you know, different blood evidence, because we had a hearing with the judge about this because we asked for it to be done really quickly before he was cremated or embalmed, and she granted our request to have early discovery, basically. We were concerned they also wouldn't autopsy him. As it turned out, they did carry out an autopsy. We hired our own specialist who did his own autopsy as well. We don't really have the results of all that, but that will be part of, I think this is part of the evidence that will be presented eventually as we move into a hearing on the merits of the lethal injection challenge.
Right. And I understand that the attorneys for Kenneth Williams called for an independent investigation into his execution. Has that happened? Has the state agreed to allow for an independent investigation?
I think the word that the governor's spokesperson used was flawless, even after the Kenneth Williams execution, which none of those witnesses, I mean, impartial media witnesses all seemed very troubled by his execution, and the word that was still used by the governor's spokesperson was flawless. So we don't expect the state of Arkansas to be admitting that there's any question about these executions.
There's no doubt in my mind none of these executions were flawless.
Well, from all that you've shared with us today, it certainly doesn't sound as though they were. Perhaps as your lawsuit moves forward, we'll learn more about what happened in Arkansas behind the scenes. Please keep us posted.
Thank you both so much for taking the time to join us. You've given us a really thorough picture of what happened in these cases. And thank you, of course, for all of the work that you did in each of the cases.
Thank you.
To learn more about the Arkansas executions and a variety of issues related to capital punishment, visit deathpenaltyinfo.org. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Discussions with DPIC, please subscribe to our podcast on your podcast app of choice.